Hi, everybody. This is God's Side for the Sad Truth. Today, I have a guest that I've often seen on Fox, that Nazi hotbed of anti-Semitism, which is kind of strange because she's one of those Jews that must hate herself because she appears on Fox, as I do oftentimes. Carol Markowitz, how you doing?
My God, thanks so much for having me.
Oh, I'm so excited to be talking to you. So much to talk about. Before we get going, let me give a brief bio of who you are. You're a weekly columnist at the New York Post and also with Fox News. You've written many, many times or met for many outlets such as the Wall Street Journal, The Spectator, Washington Examiner, and others. Can we include Washington Post in there? No,
No, no Washington Post.
no. You're currently writing a book. Now, this I'm very interested in on how wokeness destroys childhood. Maybe sort of the parasitic mind for kids. Maybe we'll talk
That's
about
right.
that.
Yes.
To be released, I think, in a few months in winter 2023. Did I cover the main points?
I think you got it. Yeah.
All right. So let's start first with a something that I've been mourning quite heavily. My heart is heavy, and it's not because the Queen has passed away, although may she rest in peace, Wicked Ann. I'm mourning because I could not process the information that Brian Stelter, however you pronounce it, has left CNN. Are you equally mourning that reality?
Oh, I mean, I'm mourning the reality that, he's much less mockable now because we don't know where he is. I think he did so much damage to just the news profession. And I think that his ratings were, kind of evidence of that. People didn't want to watch him, but he still remained on this, a show that we considered important. And he got a lot of coverage, especially from people who kind of hated him or didn't, just didn't like him. I think that's where he got the majority of his views. And I don't know. He always just struck me as somebody who said one thing and did something very, very different. He would often talk about how Fox was on Sirius, and then he would bring on like Robert De Niro to discuss Trump's mental state. He would do things like this all the time, and I just have very little respect for the man.
Do you think that, and I'm asking you here to speculate because you don't have a direct window to his mind and soul, but do you think that in the deep recesses of his mind, when he puts his head on the pillow at night, he believes the positions that he takes, or he knows it's all a bunch of performative BS, but he must do it in order to appeal to whichever group he's appealing to?
So I have tweeted this story before, but this is the first time I'm ever talking about it. During the school closures during COVID, I was a very outspoken critic of these school closures. I became, sort of a point person on this kind of thing. I wrote about it all the time. He direct messaged me and said, "I agree with you, but obviously I can't say anything about this." So yes, he absolutely knew when he was doing something wrong or was saying something that wasn't true. He finally spoke out about school closures. I think this was April 2021. I mean, a year plus after he should have. And he just, yeah, he really wasn't, again, not very high esteem in my mind
You know, it's
for
amazing
Brian Stelter.
because authenticity for me is sort of one of the foundational values, not only in the way that I present myself to the world, maybe to a fault, right? I'm authentic to a fault in that I don't modulate, I don't care,
Right.
right?
Yeah.
And so I admire people who exhibit those traits, and I'm repulsed by people who modulate, right? It doesn't even have to be at the level of lying the way Stelter does, in the sense that he may say one thing on air and believe something else. But for example, I know someone who, will only invite certain guests once they've kind of gone through a focus groups with the people that he likes. And only if they kind of give the green light, then will he invite that person because he's cared about his brand image and brand management
Yeah,
person,
it's
right?
lame.
It's so lame. Whereas, I think one of the reasons I'd like to think that one of the reasons why I resonate with so many people is precisely because I exude an aura of authenticity. And I think, and not to compare myself to Trump, he's certainly taller than me. I might be a bit more intellectual than him, I'd like to think. But I think that's what also resonated with people when it came to Trump, right? He
I
did.
agree. Yeah, he is who he is, and there's no part of him that's a lie. He's just himself, and I think, yeah, people really like that.
And one of the reasons why I've been asked, on many occasions to potentially think about, going into politics. And I thought, I mean, other than Trump, who is authentic to a fault also, I think I would be the suckiest politician because I don't lie, I don't cheat, I don't modulate. So all of the things that you're appearing with a baby so that you appear caring during the campaign season, I could never do that because it always would appear to me as though I'm being inauthentic. What are your thoughts on that?
It's funny. I knew Trump for years and years,
Did
not personally, but just being a New Yorker, he was everywhere. You'd kind of would see him around. You'd see him at a restaurant. You'd see him walking down the street. I mean, this had happened, a number of times. When he announced he was running, one of the things for me was like, there's no way he's going to kiss babies and shake hands. And I just did not think that he was going to go for it at all. But he leaned into that part of his personality completely. I thought that was going to be the greatest challenge for Trump. Like really just like being with masses of people and having them touch him and just, he was kind of a germaphobe. But no, he liked it. So maybe you would too.
Well, speaking of germaphobes, it's interesting that you say this. I think I may have mentioned this once or twice in a public setting. I'm a huge germaphobe. So much so that when we travel to a hotel, my wife will bring the whole accoutrement of our, like, so she, the sheets. I could never go inside, not my sheets. The pillowcases, she does a whole fumigation of the entire place. I mean, God bless her that we're still married, that she puts up with me. Do you suffer from any of this germophobia stuff?
So I would say before you said that, I would have said I'm also a huge germaphobe, but whoa, I'm nowhere near your
You're
level.
not God level.
No. I was born in Russia, and Eastern Europeans have this whole like no shoes in the house, obviously, but also inside clothes, outside clothes. Like I would never come in from outside and just sit on my couch, like gross. I would have to switch into my inside clothes. And so there was this moment in the beginning of COVID where everybody took off their shoes. I'm a big hand washer, and everybody started doing the inside clothes thing, and I was like, okay, this I could live with. This societal change I approve of. But yeah, bringing my own sheets to hotels, that's next
It's
level.
next level. So you came from sorry, Soviet Union or Russia? What I'm trying.
Soviet
Okay,
Union,
so
yeah. I was born in Russia, yeah.
okay, so you came at you don't have an accent, so you must have come
Right.
before the hormones kicked in. You were quite
Yes,
young.
I was under two.
Oh, there you go.
But I would say that I grew up in Russian Brooklyn, which is everybody and so many people. And my brother was born in America, and I would say he has more of a Russian accent than I do. It's just sort of the people that he was
No,
around. And
no kidding. I mean, the reason why this sort of language acquisition is top of mind because yesterday I had on my show Gary Marcus, who's a cognitive psychologist and linguist, and I was actually asking him if there is an accepted theory to the observation that past a certain magical age, if you learn a language, you could never speak it or even pronounce it in the way that it native. For example, my mother tongue is Arabic, and there is no. It's very, very unlikely that you could learn Arabic, Carol, and ever speak it as though you were a native speaker. And I was asking him, what is the most accepted theory as to why this happens? And there isn't actually a singular theory. There's kind of a hodgepodge of possible alternative theories, and so they haven't yet resolved that issue.
Yeah, hormones sounds right though. I think people who came like post hormonal change in their teens, they never really lose that accent that they had. And yeah, that makes sense to me.
Okay, so let's talk very briefly before I we're definitely going to talk about the COVID lockdowns and how you were kind of mama bear against all that stuff. But let's talk about what was your career trajectory, because oftentimes to become a neurosurgeon or a professor, there's kind of a track that you have to follow. Whereas oftentimes to become a columnist or a pundit, there isn't a direct ABCD, recipe. Tell us about your career and maybe give us some tips for aspiring future Carol Markowitzes.
So I had a blog back when blogs were a popular thing. I was a conservative blogger in New York City, and my blog was fairly small, especially by the numbers right now. But at the time, especially for my little niche, I was fairly well known. Like I would get recognized in places, even though I got like 1,800 readers a day or something. And my blog from that point kind of grew, and the public radio station in New York needed a conservative voice, and somebody recommended me. So I would write for them occasionally, and all the comments they would get would be like, I hate her, fire her, or I am never donating money ever again. But all the other blog posts on their site had like 3 comments, 5 comments. I'd have like 500. And I think it did resonate in some way. And then an editor at the New York Post, who I knew, asked me, you know, why are you writing for them? Why don't you write for us? And that's how it happened. But it was just because I loved writing. I would write for myself. I would write for free on my blog. And it just grew from there. So my advice would definitely be, do what you love and the money will follow.
Yeah. So in, forgive the shameless plug, but in my forthcoming book, I talk about sort of the recipe for the good life. And in one of the chapters, I say that arguably the two most fundamental decisions that you'll make that will either impart great happiness to you or great misery is choosing the right spouse and choosing the right profession. Because, you know, you wake up in the morning next to that person, you go to bed at night next to that person. So if you already ticked off that one that makes you happy, then you're on your way. And then if between those two events, you're doing something that you love, well, then you're well on your way to Mount happiness. Do you have any prescriptions that you'd like? I know that you're married and you have 3 kids. I'm assuming you're happily married. Do you have any prescriptions as to how we can choose the right spouse?
I married my best friend, which I know is a cliche, but we actually were best friends for like a decade. When I'd meet like a nice girl, I'd be like, oh, I have this amazing guy. You have to meet him. And we just never considered each other in that way until, you know, one day we did. So I would say cultivate friends of the opposite sex. I think that's important, and marry one of them. No.
you know,
if it works out, sure. If not, then, you know, we'll see what happens. But I really do think that intersex like friendships are important. And I don't think that people take them as seriously as they should. I think that girls hang out with girls and boys hang out with boys, and they really just don't mix that much. But I think having a mixed group is important and will lead to ultimate happiness.
So 2 things I'll say about this. Number one, do you know who Charles Murray, the political scientist, is?
Of course.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So Charles Murray was on my show a few months ago, and he sort of captured what you just said. I don't remember the quote verbatim, but it's something to the effect of marry your best friend to whom you're sexually attracted, basically. Right? So, and that really just captures it. But the second thing I was going to say regarding your prescription to fostering or intersex friendships, do you think that for most people that would be dangerous? Not from the perspective of necessarily that you're going to succumb to temptations if you're married, but in that you just might trigger jealousy, which for most people will be quite natural to have triggered. If you, right? I mean, you know, you probably don't want your husband to be super close friends and have an emotional bond with a woman who also happens to be gorgeous.
So it's funny because in our marriage, we actually have pretty strict rules about this kind of thing. Okay. And it's out in the open. I've written about it. You know, when the Mike Pence had that story about him where he doesn't have dinner with women with women who aren't his wife without other people around. I was like, oh, yeah, I completely relate to this. So part of our rules is we grandfathered in kind of old friends. You're not, you know, probably not going to just one day develop a sexual attraction for, you know, some old friend. I mean, usually. We don't have a situation where I come home and I say, oh, I met this great guy and he and I are going out to dinner tonight. And obviously that's sane and normal, but so many people were like, oh, well, you don't trust your spouse. They don't trust you. No, we have boundaries and we let ourselves exist in those boundaries. I have made male friends, but again, I don't spend like one-on-one time with them in a way that I would have when I was single. And I think that kind of thing could lead to something. I think you're drinking or you're out late and you're with people of the opposite sex, and absolutely something could develop. So while I would say make your friends, you know, have a mixed group of friends, maybe have them younger, not when you're married.
Or just ugly. Have them be ugly. Be ugly and low status.
I don't know. Even ugly, you know, I've seen so many men leave their gorgeous wives for like, far less
That's
attractive
called
than him,
variety
so.
seeking, Carol. It's called
Right.
variety seeking.
Right.
That's therein lies the tragedy of marriage, because humans have both evolved the desperate desire to engage in long-term pair bonding, because we're a biparental species. We need to bond together to raise those children. But we
Yeah.
also have a parallel system that causes us to also desire variety. And so
Right.
navigating through that tension is the whole game of life, isn't it?
Yeah. So what I would also, I've also written about this, where I think sex is the most important part of a relationship, like number one. And so many people will be like, no, you know, they wrote to me and say, like, I'm really surprised that you would say something like this. Obviously, like honesty or trust or any number of compatibility, any of these things are most important in a relationship. I'll say, and my argument against that is the only thing that separates your friendship from a loving relationship is the sex. So if you don't have, if you're not putting sex first, if it's not the most important part of your relationship, what you have is a very good friendship. And so that attraction has to be cultivated all the time. You have to maintain it. You can't just always be, you know, makeup free and sweatpants around your husband. And, you know, in reverse, I don't like the men who like don't try in front of their wives because they don't have to anymore. All of that has to be sort of cultivated in a marriage, if you if you're hoping to last.
I'm interested in the fact that you said the sweatpants and so on, because I've jokingly said that if I were emperor of the world, I would outlaw the outdoor wearing of sweatpants. I usually
Yes.
joke with my wife
Right.
that so I've done a lot of research looking at the hormonal effects of human behavior, specifically consumer behavior. And so one of the studies that I published with one of my former graduate students, we looked at the effects of the menstrual cycle on women's sexual signaling, how sexily they dress, right? Do they wear high heels? Do they beautify themselves? Do they wear scantily clad stuff? And of course, they are more likely to do that when they are in the ovulatory phase of their cycle.
Right.
So when my wife and I are walking somewhere, I'll start predicting the ovulatory status of a woman based on what she's dressed. And when,
I'm sure she loves
yeah, exactly. She says, "You know what? Shut up already. Enough with your
that.
science." But usually I joke that when I see a woman who's wearing sweatpants, I say, "Well, she's definitely not in a sexually receptive mood." So to your point,
Right,
yeah,
that's right.
that makes sense. Okay, let's talk about something that's very close and dear to your heart, which led you to leave progressive New York City to South Florida. That is the draconian COVID lockdown stuff.
Yeah.
Take it away. Say whatever you need to say about this.
So I, lifelong New Yorker, was going to raise our kids in Brooklyn. My husband's also a lifelong New Yorker from Queens. And we, you know, the idea of living somewhere other than New York was always pretty hilarious to us. Like, why would anybody ever want to do that? That's crazy. And we had moved into our dream house in March 2020, and everything was going super great. And then the pandemic hit, and we saw something from New Yorkers that we just could not unsee. And a lot of it specifically was about kids. And we wonder if it were just the two of us, if we would have just survived through it and then come out of the other side and maybe still be living there. But we couldn't deal with what they were doing to children, even though we could kind of save our own kids. So when the schools closed, all the rich liberal parents that we lived around got their kids tutors or formed pods or sent them to private schools or moved to their beach house and sent their kids to school there and never spoke up for the kids who didn't have those options. More than anything else, that was what disturbed us. It wasn't so much what they were doing to our kids, although we didn't like that at all. It was that people who did not have the resources that our children might did not have a chance, and that nobody cared about them, and that the New York that we knew, where we were all in it together when 9/11 happened or when the blackout happened and everybody wanted to be a hero, there were no heroes this time. Everybody was sort of a villain around us, and we had to get out of there.
Now, again, in the same way that I asked you to speculate about, Brian Stelter in terms of whether he believes his lies or not,
Yeah.
I'm asking you here to speculate. Do you think that the policymakers who instituted those draconian policies, if we're going to be charitable, is it because
Yeah.
they've been in a kind of the perpetual fog of war, and therefore they're implementing these, haphazard ad hoc policies? Or is there
Right.
something more willful and sort of a priori in their instituting these policies?
So it was a real mix of things. I can't point to any one thing and say this is what happened. So, I mean, one of the things was, you know, Trump derangement syndrome. Trump wanted schools to open, therefore the left in New York did not. Then there was the fact that people who stayed home in their pajamas on their laptops were sort of higher status. So teachers' unions pushed for that for their teachers, and they wanted to be in that class of people, not the people who were picking up our garbage or delivering our packages or bringing our Uber Eats, but the people that were sitting at home on the laptop and just sort of having this new life of being home a lot, baking banana bread and, you know, working out in your Peloton. So and the other thing that happened that I think really made a difference here was sort of cancel culture was hitting its peak. If you said the wrong thing, your life could be destroyed. So a lot of people who would have spoken up, who would have maybe gotten over the fact that they were suddenly agreeing with Trump, or they would have opposed the teachers union, even though that might have been their natural ally previously, didn't say anything because they were afraid of what would happen. And the truth is, a lot of people got fired, or had their, you know, friends all drop them, or just got attacks because of their positions on things like schools opening or vaccine mandates or the rest of it. But for school opening, that should have been such an easy call. It should have been like, look, Europe is super left. They're opening schools. We should do that too. But the fact that they couldn't get over the politics of it is, you know, resonates and continues to cause damage in New York to this day.
So how come, I mean, you're clearly an anti-woke person, but yet in when we spoke privately before this chat, you intimated that, you know, the main reason for leaving New York to South Florida was driven by the COVID you know, restrictions. Why wasn't it, so why weren't the other super woke things? I noticed that on Twitter, Andrew Guttman came into our thread. He's been on my show, and for those of you who don't know, who are listening to this episode, he's the gentleman who wrote this, you know, very eloquent letter for regarding his daughter who was going to one of those super posh woke schools where he couldn't stand anymore the CRT, the critical race theory, and all this kind of stuff. How come that stuff wasn't why didn't it serve as the impetus for you leaving to Florida?
So it's funny. That's actually a great question that I haven't been asked before, but I really felt like I could protect my kids against that wokeness. So I have been an open conservative my whole life. Being born in the Soviet Union means you just do not care what other people say about your political positions. And the ex-Soviet community in Brooklyn, you know, the Jewish ex-Soviet community in Brooklyn is very on the right, and they are very anti-woke. And I've always felt like I had my community support to be myself and to just be who I am. And so I would lived in a very left neighborhood called Park Slope, and I was an open conservative, and I didn't care. And I would basically introduce myself that way and say, look, I'm conservative, and if you don't like me, like, you don't have to be my friend, and you don't have to have your kids play with my kids or any of that. So I felt like I could have a shield around my kids, and my kids all went to public school in New York, and I just felt like I could kind of beat back that wokeness with them. And I would find always the people, usually immigrants also, who opposed different woke things in the schools. Like, my daughter went to this really competitive public school in New York City called Nest Plus M, and it's like one of the five standalone gifted and talented schools in the city. So whenever anything, and the population was mostly immigrant, mostly Asian, and whenever any wokeness was sort of introduced, the parents would be like, no, we're not doing this. Like, I didn't even know. They could have all been Democrats for all I know. It didn't matter. It was like they were not allowing their kids' education to be influenced by this kind of thing. So I always felt like I could just live in New York and kind of ignore the leftism, and that my kids would be fine because at home we had such a strong foundation and just such a strong basis of what we thought the world should be like that I wasn't worried about it. And I wasn't concerned until those policies closed my kids' school and made my, you know, 5-year-old at the time mask indefinitely. And just all that kind of stuff came to a head with COVID. You're right that it might have come to a head in a different way. It just it this is how it ended up playing out in our family.
Very interesting. Now, In speaking that, you're a Russian Jew, you grew up in an environment where the immigrants that come from a similar background who were Jewish were on the right. Of course, that doesn't describe the sort of Jewish political leanings in the United
No.
States. So explain to us, I mean, of course, I've got my own theories, but tell us your theory as to why the Jews such as yourself coming from other lands can assort on the right, whereas most of the super highfalutin, super progressive liberal Jews tend to be the exact opposite. Why?
So I think that they just live in a foundation of safety that a Jew elsewhere in the world simply has not had. Nobody's luckier than the American Jew. And if your family has been here for generations, if you've missed World War II and you missed communism in Europe and you missed all of these things, you missed maybe being kicked out of different countries. You know, if you've been here for 100 years, you have no idea how dangerous life is for Jews. So you could have your stupid opinions like, oh, maybe Israel is an apartheid state or shouldn't exist or blah, 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 because you don't have any fear for yourself or your family or anybody that you've ever known. But I like to say that, you know, the American Jews who petitioned to bring Soviet Jews here, we got here and they were like, oh God, no, this is a big mistake. Like, whoops, you
Cognitive
know.
dissonance.
They just assumed we would be like them, but we had seen too much. We had known too much. We couldn't possibly have the same opinions as a group that had lived in this kind of safety could have.
That's exactly right. And I would extend that point. So beyond Jews, although I'm Lebanese Jewish, so there's probably no worse place to be Jewish than in the Middle East. We had to run really fast to not have our heads, separated from the rest of our bodies. But I've argued that some of the most vociferous and dogged fighters for Western freedoms are usually immigrants, not just Jewish ones. I mean, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, right? It's precisely because we have sampled from the large buffets of possible societies, so that you
That's
know
right.
that the default society is not the West, right? It's actually anomalous to have the West. But if you've only seen the West, you've only been to that restaurant, that movie, then you don't know that there are all kinds of horrifying realities elsewhere. So you think it's the default. You don't have to fight for it. Whereas I come
That's
along and I
it.
say, wait a minute, it's not a good idea to have identity politics organize your society because I ran from the model society, which is based on identity politics. It doesn't end well. So.
That's it. Yeah, that's exactly it. They don't realize that they're lucky, that luck has such a huge role in this. You know, the fact that they got to grow up in the safe West, they just imagine that everywhere is like that if they just try hard enough. And, you know, we know that that's just not the case. And it doesn't matter how good the people are or if the system is bad, the system is bad.
Have you Do you know who Judea Pearl is? Yeah, you do. So he's the father of Daniel Pearl, who
Daniel
was
Pearl.
killed. Yeah, he was on my show recently, and I've seen him use. Although he's a very, very accomplished academic, but he's also weighed in on political issues, which I respect because I detest professors who are stick in your lane professors who only know about a small thing, and then you ask them to speak about anything else, they know nothing. And so he's talked about Zionophobia, which I like because it's kind of usurping the term Islamophobia and so on. What are your views on this growing tendency of what I consider to be absolutely virulent anti-Semites to say, oh, no, I love the Jews. It's just Zionists that I hate. Wink, wink.
I don't care how my kids turn out, but if they end up being Jewish anti-Zionists, that will be like the biggest failure. I mean, there was a comedian who said, like, all you have to do is keep your daughter off the pole. Like, all I have to do is keep my kids away from this anti-Zionist insanity, because it's a privileged outlook that is just so just damaging. And I hate, you know, I hate when Jews do it. When non-Jews are anti-Zionist, I just kind of can brush them off maybe as being not that smart or just, or probably anti-Semitic, probably, you know, not caring about dead Jews, not realizing that no, you know, the absence of a Jewish state will lead to mass Jewish death. So they're either stupid or evil, and that's it. But with when Jews are anti-Zionist, like that to me is just, it just shows that something went horribly wrong, and that they live in this deep privilege where they just don't know how bad things can get for us, and that they are included in that us, that they might sometime need that Jewish state themselves. Right. So yeah, stupid or evil is sort of where I end up on that.
And by the way, just so that, because I'm sure people will start writing to me saying, oh, but surely you can appreciate that people can criticize specific Israeli policy. You know, I mean, no kidding, right. Of course. I mean, I can do it too. But the idea that, you know, 57 Islamic countries can exist as Islamic countries, but a small area that certainly the Jews have historical rights to, that is probably the size, if I'm not mistaken, of New Jersey or something, and they are surrounded by 400 million of supremely unfriendly neighbors, that one people doesn't have right to that personal agency,
right,
is the definition of being anti-Jewish.
Absolutely. And the thing is that, like, yeah, you can criticize Israel. There's a lot to criticize in about every country, but we never negotiate the existence of France. We're never like, oh, those French people, they've done this, and this wrong. You know, they can't even keep a republic going for that long. You know, they shouldn't exist. You know, it's like you have to start from the premise of the existence of Israel is not up for debate. Sometimes I think that we should maybe stop using Zionist altogether, because it's like, obviously you're a Zionist. It's like accepting that America exists. It's accepting that any country exists. It shouldn't be something specific to Israel that we can continue to debate whether or not this one country should exist, shouldn't exist. It exists, period, end of story. And it would be so much better for Israel's foes, even or the Palestinian people, to accept that. And their lives would improve immeasurably if they started from that basis of, you're not getting rid of this country. It's going to continue no matter what you say or do. So now what? How do you grow from this? What happens next?
Right. Well, you know, what amazes me is the hypocrisy of many people who levy these accusations at the state of Israel. Because, well, first of all, I have a lot of family. I mean, although I'm not this kind of rah-rah Israel guy, but you know, in the abstract, of course, I support the right of Israel to exist. I have tons of my family that lives there. But then the people will come at you and say, but that's a ethno state founded on, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then that person will be named Ahmad Muhammad Hussein. And then I'll say, can I go with the Star of David in wherever he comes from Raqqa, Syria, from Cairo, Egypt, from in Kuwait, in Algeria, you know, how many Supreme Court judges are Jewish in Mogadishu? So the level of hypocrisy, the standard that you expect of the Jewish state that you perfectly recognize is a lot more rights for minorities in Israel than anywhere else where you hail from. It's just, it's galling, right? You wonder, how could you hold these two positions other than if you are a anti-Semite? Because otherwise you could never reconcile that hypocrisy.
That's right. I wear my Jewish star. I'm not going anywhere where I have to take it off. You know, I have a lot of people say to me, like, oh, go to Dubai. And I'm like, can I be openly Jewish there? They're like, well, yeah, just don't tell anybody. I'm like, but I don't want to not tell anybody. Yeah. I want to just be myself and not have to hide any part of myself. So even in places that are considered, you know, modern or just have changed or maybe have improved in some way, all these countries making, you know, kind of peace deals with Israel, it's all great. But if I can't be openly Jewish there, it's, you know, it's not quite where I needed to be before I visit.
Got you. Let's go back to your writing career. How do you choose we'll talk in a second about your forthcoming book, but, you know, as a columnist, every week you're thinking of a new thing to talk about. How is there a decision-making process that guides why you're going to write about XYZ in a given week?
No, it's sort of whatever I'm interested in. I have a really good perch at the Post where they let me do whatever I want. And especially during COVID, my editor, Sora Bamari, at the time would let me hit the same topic all the time because I just couldn't get over that schools were closed or the masks were continued to be mandatory or that vaccine mandates were being pushed everywhere. And so I kept hitting these topics over and over again because I felt that they were so important. And the Post let me do it. So I never really had, so, you know, I get like the mail that, oh, did Rupert Murdoch tell you to write this? And I always say, like, I wish, because sometimes, you know, I pitch my ideas on Fridays and like on Thursdays, and like, oh, what am I writing about this week? And I wish Rupert would just, you know, message me and say, like, hey, I'd like for you to write about this, you know, but it never actually happens. So it's sort of whatever I'm into that week.
I mean, part of the reason why I asked that is because going back to earlier, I mentioned when we were talking about monogamy versus sexual variety. So in my forthcoming book, I have a whole chapter on variety seeking. It could be sexual variety seeking, it could be food variety seeking. I talk about intellectual variety seeking. So when I mentioned earlier that I don't like professors who are in stick in your lane, well, that is exactly speaking to that, right? Being interdisciplinarian, wanting to explore many intellectual landscapes is really part of what defines the richness of my existence, right? I want to go all over the place. I want to listen to all kinds. So to me, I very much respect people who are able to write about COVID lockdowns 1 week and then talk about the ritual of auctions at Sotheby's the next week, right? That to me is beautiful. So do you see yourself exploring completely new lands, or will you always be sort of within the cultural political sphere?
So I tend to stay in the cultural political sphere, but I feel like I can go into other areas as well. And I have. I've been writing for the Post for like 10 years. I've been all over the place with my topics. I have to say that I think that so much about social media pushes you towards just sort of one area, which I don't love. Like, so for example, I always have people say to me, like, oh, you know, why don't you start a podcast, you know, about schools or about kids or whatever? And like, you know, if I were to start a podcast, it wouldn't be about that at all. It would be about something else entirely. I feel like, for example, happiness. I would love to explore the concept of happiness, especially in women, but in all people, or something along those lines. So I love the idea of thinking about all kinds of different things. I definitely come back to topics that make that matter to me personally, which does tend to be things about children's issues or about education or things like that. But as my kids get older, I don't want to be pigeonholed into just that kind of thing, because you know, I will be interested in other things as they, you know, get older and go to college and et cetera. So, I agree with you though. I love the idea of exploring a lot of different topics and thinking about a lot of different things deeply and not just being one thing.
So, another metric of variety, if you'd like, is the form of writing that you engage in, right? So when you're writing a column, I'm assuming it's what, 1,000, 2,000 words? Is that roughly the
It's like 700.
700? Okay, there you go. Now, that's a very, very different style and process than, say, a book. This is your first book that you're writing right
First
now.
book.
Okay.
Writing it. So it's not at the publisher yet. It's at the copy editor, so it hasn't been like officially announced. We don't have a title yet. But it is loosely about how wokeness destroys childhood and how many different ways that plays in. People just assume, oh, just schools, but there's a million different ways that wokeness seeps into our culture and affects our kids, and the book is going to be about that.
What was your writing process?
Ooh, it's so hard. How do you do this?
I know, it's amazing, huh?
No, I don't know. I'm still very much in it. Like, I guess I said, the book is with the copy editor now, so I don't know what the next, you know, kind of steps are going to be. But it was so much harder than I had imagined. I thought, oh, you know, I write these columns every week. Sometimes my columns, I'll write for like the Washington Examiner magazine. I have a column this week. It's 1,600 words. Sometimes it's 3,500 words. So I've done longer pieces. I was like, oh, this is, you know, this is going to be in the same vein as that. It's just going to be like 10 really long pieces. It wasn't like that at all. So it was about, for me, delving deep into what I wanted to say, more than just getting the facts on the page. A lot of times for me, it'll be about this, these are the facts that I want to get out there. this is the, you know, rhetorical flourish that I want to put on it. I like being funny. Funny is important to me. So here are some funny lines in my columns about, you know, what the topic that I'm writing. But for the book, I had to get really into, like, why would somebody read this? Or what am I telling them that they don't know? What connections am I making for them that they maybe they hadn't had made for them before? So it was really deep, and in a way that I hadn't imagined it would be.
The reason I ask is, well, first of all, I'm interested in the creative process in general, whether you're a chef or an architect or an author or a scientist. Yeah. One of the things I talk about in my next book is that one of the best ways to seek occupational fulfillment is to be within the creative industry in whichever form, right? To create is a clear path to purpose and meaning. But the reason I asked the question is because, in, not unlike how in your case, there's a distinction between your columns and writing a book, because of course one is much longer than the other. So as an academic, of course, I'm tasked with writing, you know, peer-reviewed papers. Now, the content of the paper changes from paper to paper, but the template is always the same. There's an introduction to the problem. There's a literature review. There is a hypothesis. Here's the methodology. Here's the data analysis. Here's the conclusion. What I put in it changes, but that's already set. With a book, there is no template, right? I mean, other than knowing that there are chapters and there are paragraphs, everything is up for grabs. And so, but I found that process to be really mystical, and it really amounts to whether you're a good storyteller or not. I remember one agent that I was speaking to, subsequently I got rid of him. He was useless. But he was saying, it would be great if you write your latest book in the way you present yourself on Joe Rogan. And then I said, well, what do you mean? The way I present myself on Joe Rogan is the way I present myself in every setting. He goes, yes, don't be super professorial, because I think he was concerned that if I write for a large public, you know, a trade book, I might not be able to make the switch from my academic books or my academies writing style. Whereas I think I've shown that I can have different voices. So in your case, did you have to kind of navigate similar distinctions between the columnist voice and the author voice?
Absolutely. So just like you, with a column, there's a very much a structure. There's the intro sentence that will draw the person in, and then there's the explanation of what I mean, and then there's sort of my take on it, and then there's a conclusion about what we should do about it. And that was all thrown out with the book. But yes, the voice is so interesting because it's still me. It's just a different side of me. It's so one of the chapters, I haven't spoken about this at all, but one of the chapters in the book is about my family's Soviet history, and about how, my great-grandfather was sentenced to the gulag, and how he died there, and just getting into all of that into this book. And being, again, I enjoy being funny. I like having laugh lines and getting kind of more serious in that chapter, for example. I think I still had some lightness in other places, but it's just a different side of you. You're still you, and still, you know, you're still the guy you were on Joe Rogan, but, you know, maybe on this other podcast, you kind of laughed more or whatever. So I like the idea of showing different sides. And I think that, for example, my next book, I could see it being on something else entirely. And, we'll see where that goes.
So you've been bitten by the authorship bug.
No, actually, why did I say that? There is no next book. No, never again. This is awful.
I'm assuming you're being facetious. We'll see. Okay. Yeah. So, you're still a young woman, but at this point in your life, do you have any enduring, looming, torturing regrets? Oh, I should have become a dancer. I should have gone to medical school.
No. I'm the Jewish, like, I knock wood, because I wake up every day and I can't believe that things worked out the way it did, that I married my best friend, that I got to be a writer. When I was a kid, I told my parents I wanted to be a writer, and they were like, are you crazy? No. Like, it was like, just do not even entertain this ridiculous idea. Nobody becomes a writer. Like, that's not a thing. You could be a doctor. You could be a lawyer at the time. You could be a computer programist. Like, that was it. And maybe an accountant these days, but that's it. Those are the options for a child born in the Soviet Union who had been lucky enough to move to America. Obviously, you weren't going to throw that away by being a writer. That's crazy. So, no, I feel super lucky and super blessed. And this move to Florida has been so eye-opening about how life can be, and that, wow, life exists outside New York City, and it's amazing, and it's freeing. And it's just so good.
You know, when you mentioned earlier when you lived in New York and you wondered why would anybody live other than New York?
Right.
I say the exact same thing, except that I replace New York by Newport Beach, California. Because we lived in Newport Beach for a few years. I was a professor at UC Irvine, and I've had family there since, you know, the 1984, 1985, roughly. And so it feels like a second home to me, although psychologically, emotionally, it feels as though that's my home and I'm just permanently visiting Montreal. And so in a sense, you leaving, you know, New York to Florida, did it demystify the promised land of New York? Is it no longer this magical place that you thought it was?
I don't know. I think New York was pretty magical. I think it was an amazing place to grow up, even in the bad days. And then when it got good during the Giuliani and Bloomberg years, it was amazing. It was so good. Like, everything was just, you know, you had all the positives of New York, and then like all the negatives decreased, like crime was really low, and like it just got easier to live there. I thought it was amazing. I thought it was a great place to be. I definitely still have some, you know, mystique about it, but I have no interest in being there. And I compare it, you know, sort of to an ex that you really did care about, but like it just didn't work out.
Right.
And you root for them and you want them to succeed and you hope for the best and stay in touch. Why not? I'll come visit every now and again. But no, never be back together.
The reason why that general topic of moving is kind of personally relevant in our lives is because I'm in a bit of a, and I don't mind sharing this, even if my university watches this, who cares? I'm at a bit of a fork in the road, a bifurcation, in that while it has always been in my DNA to be a professor, and I only want to be two things in life, a professional soccer player and a professor from a very young age. So I really lived out exactly what I needed to be or wanted to be. But, you know, Montreal is cold weather. Montreal has Quebec and Canada have unbelievably punitive confiscatory tax system. That has really hit me hard existentially, especially with the book royalties of my last book. You know, I'm tired. I'm just, you know, I hate the idea that you can't protect yourself in Canada. As Justin Trudeau explained to us, there is no fundamental right of self-defense in Canada, which, you know, it's unbelievable that you could say that out loud. Like, which fundamental right is more fundamental than the right
None.
For me to protect myself, right?
Yep.
And so my wife and I have been talking very seriously as to whether, you know, it's time for us to move. And we have probably common friends who live in Florida who keep telling me, when are you moving? What are you doing? Why are you being irrational?
I mean, I would say that I was like, oh, I'm going to be on God's podcast for sure. I'm going to pitch Florida because you belong here. We have a whole crew. It's really good. You would fit right in. And it's a place to go to be free. I don't know that it's always going to be Florida. I think Governor DeSantis plays a large role in that. But it does feel so freeing to be here. You just know you're not going to have to deal with so many ridiculous policies or implications of those policies. It's a feeling that I cannot describe, but I think you would enjoy very much.
From your lips to God's ear.
Please.
Thank you. You're very kind. By the way, here's a question for you. Do you know who David Beckham is?
Yeah, of course.
Do you think that if I were to move to Florida, it would put Florida above the threshold of permissible good looks? Because right now with David Beckham, okay, we're there.
Right,
I move
right.
to Florida, all bets are off.
You know, well, Florida's a place of very, very pretty people. So I feel like you'd fit right in, and, you know, people, it'd be you and Beckham. And
I'm liking you more and more by the second. You're playing into my my faux egos. By the way, I hate how people who don't have a sense of humor don't appreciate that style of humor. So I know that you follow me on social media. So, you know, I'll put a picture of myself. And I say, gorgeous, stunning, stupendous. And the beach is also nice, right? Now, most people get right. that I'm joking. But then, mm-hmm. of course, my haters will say, what a narcissist. What is this? Do you think there's something unique about Jews that allows them to have a more developed sense of humor, if I can put it that way? Is that a thing?
Maybe, or also just be like accepting of attractiveness as a quality. You know, when my daughter was little, I said to my husband, like, maybe we shouldn't tell her how beautiful she is all the time. He's like, we're Jews. Obviously, we're going to tell her how beautiful she is all the time. This is what we do. But yeah, look, you know, poking fun at yourself and sort of being both self-deprecating or kind of flaunting yourself. I'm all for it. I don't know if it is a Jewish characteristic, but I enjoy it very much. I love your social media.
Oh,
I think you really
have
a good thing going.
Thank you so much. You're very sweet. Okay. So I know that you've plugged your book. Last question before I let you go, and we could say goodbye offline as well. Are there any other projects other than your forthcoming book on wokeism in children that you'd like to use this opportunity to plug?
No, I'm in the post every Monday. I, you know, welcome your audience to come check me out. My Twitter is @Carol, just my first name, KAROL, and you know, try to be funny and interesting and, you know, follow your lead.
Oh, aren't you sweet? Thank you so much.
And good looking, obviously.
And good looking. By the way, I saw you recently, before I say goodbye, I think I saw you recently with Megyn Kelly. Uh-huh. And I loved your appearance there. I think she's one of the loveliest honey badgers. Not only honey badger, beautiful, intelligent. She's got all these little witticisms that she says. She's fantastic. I'll be appearing on her show for the second time in October. So there you go.
Nice.
Hey, Carol, thank you so much. I can't wait
so much
to be drinking some margaritas with you at the beach in
Florida.
And don't worry, husband of Carol, despite my haunting good looks, it'll only be a platonic friendship. Thank you so much, Carol.
Yeah, thank you.
Cheers.